From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last Saturday, an American Black Hawk helicopter landed in a clearing somewhere in eastern Afghanistan, and three Special Forces fighters emerged. Taliban fighters were waiting for them with American Bo Bergdahl, their prisoner for the last 5 years. Moments later at Guantanamo Bay, five Taliban prisoners were handed over to Qatari authorities on their way to freedom. That's the straightforward part of the story. The rest gets complicated. This hour on Point, the unfinished story of Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, the swap, and America's exit from Afghanistan. You can join us on air or online with this conversation is always on. How do you know now see Bo Bergdahl, the swap, the deal? Is this just how exits go? Will it come back to bite us? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Andrew Tillman, Pentagon Bureau Chief for the Military Times. He's been reporting on this story closely. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Where's Bo Bergdahl now, Sergeant Bergdahl?
Sergeant Bergdahl is at a hospital in Germany. He's listed in stable condition. Pentagon hasn't really said anything about his health issues other than to say they're worried about his nutrition. He wasn't eating well during the past 5 years of captivity. But it's my understanding he's not spoken with his family, and he's in the early phases of what they call the reintegration process.
There's a big uproar on a couple of fronts. One is on Bo Bergdahl himself and how he left the base. The other is the swap that's taken place here. Are you following that in Washington? Does it seem Harry Reid's calling it Monday morning quarterbacking? But there are tough criticisms here of trading this prisoner for five what are being called Taliban commanders. Is that a fair description of those who were released from Guantanamo? And what's the Pentagon saying about the rectitude of this exchange?
Well, I think that's a fair description. I mean, these guys were clearly high-level operational Taliban leaders. Several of them, I think, were captured shortly after the invasion of 2001. I mean, these are guys that the Taliban had been asking for some time. And I think there's kind of two prongs to this. There's one on Capitol Hill. There's concerns about the president's judgment call to make this swap and whether he notified Congress in time. And then there's kind of inside the military community, there's essentially a separate issue that says, okay, you know, we leave no man behind. We take care of our own. We've got Bo Bergdahl back now. But this is no regular POW. This guy left under some very dubious, if not reckless, circumstances, and there should be talk of, in many people's eyes, of some kind of discipline, if not a court-martial.
You have reported on a classified military investigation, but that some senior officers are talking about, that looked at the circumstances of his departure, and the conclusion was what?
Well, it's my understanding that the Army did a pretty thorough investigation in the year following this and found that he left his base. Now, it's not sure why he left the base, and it's not sure there's no indication at this point that he was leaving permanently. In fact, someone suggested to me that he had been talking to his fellow soldiers about a desire to leave the base and that maybe he had even done it and returned unharmed. And I think it's important to remember the context of Bo Bergdahl in 2009. I mean, this was just after Obama had come to office. He was surging troops over there. There was a lot of attention. This was the height of the so-called fighting season. And Bo Bergdahl was at a very austere forward operating base with only a couple dozen soldiers. I mean, this guy was really at the tip of the spear, as they say.
People are trying to understand Bo Bergdahl. You've reported he may have gone off base before, but here he went without body armor, without his rifle. Left with very little, in fact. He had written very critically of his base and the discipline there, the circumstances there. Rolling Stone wrote about this a couple of years ago. Everybody's reading it again now. Bo Bergdahl was writing, the U.S. Army is the biggest joke in the world. Says it's an army of liars, backstabbers, fool. The good sergeants are getting out as soon as they can, telling us privates to do the same. This was a homeschooled young man from Idaho who had thought about reportedly joining the French Foreign Legion first, been rejected there, but had been received pretty well in basic training. What about his description of unit discipline at this base in Afghanistan where he was stationed?
Yeah, I mean, he had been evidently very critical of everything from top to bottom, everything from the way things on his little tiny patrol base were handled all the way up through high-level U.S. foreign policy. And I think that one of the interesting side stories here is just sort of the and one of the reasons I think that a lot of service members now are having kind of a visceral reaction to this is because Bo Bergdahl was very much a loner. He studied the Pashto language, which was pretty unusual for a soldier. He talked about Buddhism. He had these criticisms of the American government. I mean, he was clearly odd man out in the tightly knit military culture. And I think that that is kind of a subtext of a lot of the discussions going on these days.
He wrote there, again, from the Rolling Stone report, from Bo Bergdahl, wrote, "The future is too good to waste on lies, as well as to spend it helping fools with ideas that are wrong. I have seen their ideas. I'm ashamed even to be American," he wrote. "The horror of the self-righteous arrogance that they thrive in, it's all revolting." But then he was gone, and the assertion by some who served with him, and we'll hear from one in just a moment, is that lives may have been lost searching for him after he walked off.
Yeah, there's been an awful lot of talk this week about whether it's fair to say that Bo Bergdahl is to blame in some direct or indirect way for three, four, five, maybe six deaths that occurred following his disappearance. You know, I think it's a very dubious thing to try to draw direct correlations between one event and a combat casualty. I mean, there's the it's hard to cut through the fog of war and to draw a direct correlation like that. But his disappearance did prompt a sweeping search and rescue mission that involved thousands of troops, and there were several troops that were killed during those missions. And you know, I think it's unfair to say that those guys would have been back on their patrol base playing Xbox had they not been searching for Bo Bergdahl. But you know, that was the mission of the day, and that's what's leading some people to sort of say that Bo Bergdahl is to blame for those deaths.
We're going to look more at Bo Bergdahl, at the swap, the exchange, who was informed, who wasn't. Andrew Tillman covers it all from the Military Times, Pentagon bureau chief there with us from Washington. I want to go to someone who served in the same unit as Bo Bergdahl. With us right now from Jakarta, Indonesia, is former Army Captain Nathan Bradley Bethay. He was in the 1st Battalion, 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment in Paktika Province with Bo Bergdahl. Joins us from Indonesia. Nathan Bethay, thank you very much for being with us.
How are you doing, Tom? Thank you.
We're well. You've been quite critical of both Bo Bergdahl himself, his walking away, and the aftermath of that walk away. How do you see what happened there on this base in Paktika, Nathan?
I know what was reported from the first hours after he went missing, and that was he had been relieved off of his guard shift the night prior, and rather than sleeping, apparently he left the majority of the items that belonged to him, aside from a few things like a compass, a knife, his journal, some water, and a digital camera, and departed. And there was he was not seen again. In that kind of a situation, every single person who could received a change of mission, and the focus became to find him. It stirred up so many things, and I do believe that it worsened the situation there in Paktika Province, in all of Regional Command East, because of just the sheer overwhelming disruption that it caused to the Afghan civilians there. It really did make us a lot of enemies and put a lot of guys in harm's way.
You were there with Bo Bergdahl and his fellow soldiers. You were one of them. How was his disappearance understood at the time?
The first thing was he's gone. Nobody could they could explain it. And you know, there was the first thought was, okay, everybody check, make sure he didn't go back on some patrol we didn't know about, make sure that he wasn't in a latrine or something. And those they ran out of answers. There was no answer. He was gone. And then people started talking in Blackfoot Company, and that started to make its way through the battalion because these updates were taking place daily over voice, you know, voice over IP briefings that we do. And it was the soldiers were saying, my God, he was talking about how I want to walk to China, I want to walk to India, I want to walk to Pakistan. They had done a mission in a more remote part of Paktika called Omna District, and they had wound up in his platoon had wound up spending at least a week, I think maybe longer, in Omna. And he had first mentioned, God, it would be so cool to walk off into these mountains in Omna. all these conversations that soldiers had had with him started to surface. And to be fair, a lot of it was hearsay. It was the, we call it like rumor intelligence. It got spread around quite a bit. But the strange thing about this story was that the stories from different people who knew him kept coming up the same.
A British documentary filmmaker with The Guardian was out with the unit and brought back a film that he said described, you know, soldiers who no longer cared, breaking all the most basic rules of combat. Had discipline broken down? Was this unit a mess?
What you were writing, I believe, was, or what you were quoting there was Mike Hastings' story. And what I would say about it was that that unit was under an inordinate amount of stress. Blackfoot Company was stretched to the limits. They were in charge of, I want to say, four of the districts that our battalion owned. They were just a regular infantry company of about 120 people. Mm-hmm. You know, and while you're deployed, you typically have at least 10% of those people gone on leave. So you still have so many other functions that you have to fill on at your company headquarters. What that creates is a situation when there was maybe you needed at least 30 guys on this base, and you had maybe 45 to 50 from which to draw. And so, yes, they got in trouble, don't get me wrong, for what happened when the photographer took pictures of them. But
out of regular order, to say the least. We'll look at that and more. Nathan Bradley Bethe, please stand by. In Jakarta, Indonesia, former Army captain who served with Bo Bergdahl. Andrew Tillman with the Military Times in Washington. We have a lot to look at here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the unfinished story of Bo Bergdahl and Afghanistan. Talking with Andrew Tillman from the Military Times, who's covered this, with Nathan Bradley Bethe, former Army captain who served with Bergdahl in Afghanistan. Everyone's talking about this over the last few days. The president talking about it in Europe, saying it's a sacred rule. No matter what, the United States does not leave men and women in uniform behind.
The United States has always had a pretty sacred rule, and that is we don't leave our men or women in uniform behind.
The president making that case there in Europe as controversy has swirled around this swap, this release, new video footage out from the Taliban itself, where you can see the Black Hawk landing, special forces coming out, Taliban walking Bo Bergdahl toward them, dressed in white, his face covered. It's a very, very fast exchange. 30 seconds is all it was on the ground. Meanwhile, back at Guantanamo, five Taliban commanders hand it over to Qataris, who will take them to Qatar. The deal is for a year before they are free to go where they like. Taliban is celebrating all this. You can hear just a little bit here of that celebration as they film this. Video camera rolling. You can hear them cheering, "Long live Mujahideen, long live their leader Mullah Omar." Taliban trumpeting this as a victory. The last American POW in Afghanistan. Back now on an American base in Germany. We've got callers for the two of you, Andrew and Nathan. Daniel in Clarksville, Tennessee. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I held a position in Afghanistan where I kind of was privy to information. None of the information I had was super secret information. So what I'm going to say isn't something that the gentleman on the phone or anyone who had to do with the Army wouldn't know. But first couple of times we tried to find him. I was on missions where we tried to find him, and the first couple of times we tried to find him, we realized that he wasn't trying to be found. We realized that really quick. He got something that we like to call the terrorist starter kit, where he had a wife, he had a house, he was being taken care of, and he could have literally walked back onto any FOB in Afghanistan.
You're saying he was given a wife or found one with the Taliban, given a house sort of set up nicely? Is that what you're asserting, Daniel?
He was being taken care of. He was not being held at gunpoint or anything like that.
And you're saying you know that from what? From military intelligence reports? That's a big assertion. It's a lot to take on faith, but what's your source?
Well, my source is I was in a position in Afghanistan where I was able to see something that we call NSUM and GRINSUMs, and we tried to get him many times.
Daniel, stand by, if I may. Let me take just that piece to Andrew Tillman. We have to be very careful here. There's the reputation of a young man at stake, Andrew Tillman, and I can't vouch for anything that we've just heard. But you're a reporter at the Pentagon. You have talked to officers who know the classified report here. Does that make any sense to you?
I have not heard anything along those lines from officialdom. I've not heard that that is included in the official Army investigation. I have heard some secondhand reports that suggested that the soldiers on the ground at the time thought that he may have been trying to link up with the Taliban or may have been behaving in a way that would suggest a sympathy for the Taliban. And I think that, I don't know, that's all very unconfirmed, and I don't know anybody who's really vouching for that in officialdom. But I do think that raises a really interesting point legally. I was talking to a military justice expert the other day, and when talking about, what Bo Bergdahl, what kind of misconduct he may be on the hook for, there's a huge distinction between just, violation of an order by leaving your base and desertion in a way that suggests that you're aiding and abetting and offering comfort to the enemy. So, the distinction that Daniel just suggested has huge legal implications.
Which he may face upon his return home. Uniform Code of Military Justice, if a soldier commits desertion, it is desertion if he quits his unit, organization, or place of duty with intent to avoid hazardous duty or shirk important service. Desertion during wartime punishable by death or other such punishment as a court-martial may direct. But that is the point at which this will all have to be very carefully weighed. This is really serious business, and we do not know, speaking right here. Nathan Bradley Bethay, you were a former Army captain, served alongside him. Does that story make any sense to you?
One thing that I'd like to point out about what Daniel described is that a lot of those source reports that were coming in were from Afghan sources, and they would get vetted over time if they gave information that was accurate. But I remember a lot of wild stories coming as well at that time that there would be no way to actually independently verify. A point that Andrew raised, I would say, is that I believe that the soldiers who were there in Afghanistan have evidence that Bo Bergdahl deserted. But desertion and defection are two very different things, and it would get into the province of wild conjecture if we start talking about all of the things that the Afghan sources have put forward. Because I've heard a lot of very out there things, if that makes any sense.
How did you try to find Bo Bergdahl in the weeks and months after he showed up gone? And how do you support your claim that there were numerous deaths in this effort?
As soon as we realized he was gone, the brigade and basically Regional Command East created independent operations where they would send as many platoons as they could to different targets, different villages they thought were affiliated. This would entail days, weeks at a time. I know of one guy who his platoon didn't get back for 10 days, or just nonstop missions, searching every house in these villages. And lots of guys got hurt in the process of that. The guys that died, it is very murky in a sense that what Bergdahl caused created so many ripple effects in terms of enraging the civilian population, exacerbating the insurgency. And even once he was in Pakistan, we still were looking for information to get him back. And so the Taliban commanders, the local insurgents that were linked to potentially the people that we thought had Bergdahl, they were high-profile targets. And there are instances, I believe, of guys that were actioning those targets that got killed. Now, in terms of during that search in the initial part of July, I personally helped some guys off the flight line at Forward Operating Base Sharana who had been wounded. One guy had gotten shot right through his helmet, from the side of the helmet, and it split it, had cut his face up. He was a soldier in 3rd Battalion, 509th Infantry, but obviously they weren't dead. What I would say is that those initial weeks were frantic, really busy, really dangerous, and there were a lot of soldiers that nearly died. It came in very serious enemy fire. But the thing to remember with Bergdahl is that it drove operations for the remainder of our deployment. It's just that it wasn't a search and rescue mission. It was a conduct counterinsurgency operations with the purpose of figuring out who's got him and finding out how we can get him back.
The president saying over the weekend in Europe, it doesn't matter that no soldier left behind is the American policy. Period, full stop, he said.
Regardless of the circumstances, whatever those circumstances may turn out to be, we still get an American soldier back if he's held in captivity. Period. Full stop. We don't condition that.
And that has been policy for a long time. Brian in Holden, Massachusetts is calling. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's great to talk with you. And I'm glad you played that clip from the president, because I agree 100% with what he says. I'm the father of a deployed soldier in the Middle East, and I think it really is a responsibility to take to make sure we bring all of our men and women home. And, you know, we don't really know all the circumstances here. There's all sorts of conjecture and rumors and that kind of thing.
Yep.
And we don't know his state of mind. And I just want to remind everyone about, you know, the Pat Tillman situation where he was killed by his own troops. And that information took a long, long time to get out.
It was deliberately concealed.
Deliberately concealed. And so what I would like to do is just get this guy home. And if he was a deserter or a traitor, I think those facts will come out. But I think this kind of idea where, you know, this conjecture and these accusations going back and forth, we ought to be grateful this man is brought home. And then let's let the facts come out afterwards, and he'll be punished accordingly if he's guilty of
Brian, I appreciate your call, and I wish your son a safe deployment. Thank you for calling. Nathan Bradley Bethay, what about the policy? No soldier left behind, and the president says, regardless of the details here, this applies to every American military man and woman, and we're not backing off of it. Do you agree with that, having served there in Afghanistan with Bo Bergdahl?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I support it. I believe that every soldier should be able to trust that no matter what, right or wrong, their government will do everything they can to get them back. And I think that the political reality of the situation is that the president would be condemned by certain aspects of American politics, regardless of what he did in this situation. And so I will always support the decision to bring an American soldier home if we have the ability to do that. People do dumb things. People make mistakes. I do believe that he has a lot to answer for, but I want that to come out through an investigation done by the Army on American soil. I want him home with his family. I don't wish detention by the Taliban on any human being.
This was a time of terrible fighting in Afghanistan, 2009, spring of 2009. President Obama had ordered the first troop surge. The numbers would go way up. They weren't way up yet. Just take us back there for a moment before we let you go. What was it like on that base? You know, the picture painted in Rolling Stone is of sort of Vietnam style, kind of chaotic and off the hook. And what was it like? You were there.
Okay, if you envision this, the modern forward operating base that has existed in Afghanistan and Iraq, this is not it. It was an OP basically established to help the Afghan National Police try to stop roadside bombs from being emplaced along a north-south running road. It was not a base. It was really an outpost between the village of Mest and Malak in, I want to say it's Yusuf Kel district of Paktika province. Mm-hmm. It was a tower made of concrete reinforced with sandbags on a hill. Aside from that, they had a watershed, and they parked their vehicles and had strung concertina wire around them with some cement barriers. They slept in poncho hooches, like you described, the sort of Vietnam-style patrol base. It was as austere as anything I've ever seen in the 13 months I spent deployed or anywhere else I've been in the military. And because of the situation with how high stress it was at that time, right before his departure, preparing for the election, and with the situation in Blackfoot Company, just with what they had, they were responsible for patrolling. It was undermanned. They were keeping platoons out there for 6, 7, 8 days at a time with no refit, and then bringing them back for a few hours. So it was as, like you said, the tip of the spear. It was as far from the vestiges of home as you could possibly get in Afghanistan.
And your last memory of Bo Bergdahl himself, do you have one?
I don't, because I didn't know him personally. He was in Blackfoot Company. I was mm-hmm. in Headquarters Company. Mm-hmm. I saw his picture for the first time and heard his name for the first time in my battalion executive officer's office. He was showing that same photo of him with the maroon beret and the American flag. And he said, I guess this guy's missing. But then that name became such an important part of all of our experiences, and it still is to this day.
And now 5 years later, the whole world watching this story. Nathan Bradley Bethay, former Army captain who served in the same unit as Bo Bergdahl, joining us today from Jakarta, Indonesia. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
Andrew Tillman, standby in Washington. With us right now from New York is David Rode. He's an investigative reporter for Reuters. He was a reporter for the New York Times when, in 2008, he was captured by the same group that held Bo Bergdahl. He was held for 7 months before he escaped. Two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. David Rode, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You were held by this same group. What does that lead you, or how does that lead you to imagine or think about what these 5 years must have been like for Bo Bergdahl?
Everything I've seen from the captive videos that have come out, and even this video this morning of his release, matches the way I was treated. And I want to—I think the earlier caller was well intentioned in terms of this story about him having a wife. There may have been an Afghan that sort of said that, but I believe this young man needs to answer these questions. There's no question that he caused a huge problem for the U.S. military, and lives may have been lost as a result. But I believe he was taken immediately into Pakistan, where the Taliban have a safe haven. And, this talk that he somehow wanted to join the Taliban or had a wife is just – it's very unfair to him until he's able to speak his side of this story. Everything I've seen shows that he was a prisoner like me, and it was probably an incredibly difficult 5 years.
You escaped. He did not. What do you make of that? Anything at all?
He tried to. There was a report that Bo Bergdahl did escape and was recaptured, and that when they found him, he fought like mad. It took multiple Taliban fighters to get control of him and drag him back into captivity. Again, he's got huge questions to answer, but I was able to escape successfully because I was not kidnapped alone. I was kidnapped with an Afghan journalist and Afghan driver, and that Afghan journalist, we escaped, and he led me to a Pakistani military base that the Afghan journalist had found. He was taken outside the house we were held sometimes by our guards. So Bo didn't have, an Afghan with him who would help him. And, I was able to speak English with this Afghan. Bo was in total isolation. I don't think he was around any English speakers for the last 5 years.
And then to this swap and the negotiation, the talks, Qatar right in the middle of all this, Andrew Tillman, what's being said now is, well, we have a formal policy. We don't negotiate with terrorists, but here we've just done it and we've set a bad precedent. Perhaps that's not even the Pentagon's problem. Perhaps that's a White House issue. Perhaps that goes to the civilian or at least the crossover zone here. But what are you hearing around the Pentagon about the deal, the swap, Andrew?
Well, I think that military guys tend to want to stay in their lane, as they say, and I do think you're right that those questions are for the civilian leadership, for the White House. The judgment call that the president ultimately made that these five Taliban leaders at Guantanamo were worth the trade, that was the commander-in-chief's call. So I think that at the Pentagon, people have been really focused on just the fact that we were able to adhere to that leave no man behind ethos. And I think that the debate that's sort of emerging on Capitol Hill is a really fraught and tangled legal question that I wouldn't be surprised if it went to the Supreme Court, of whether, Congress passing this law regarding the handling of detainees, well, that infringes on the commander-in-chief's authority. I mean, clearly Congress can't say to the president, no one can go out on patrol in Afghanistan unless
right.
Congress approves. And at some point, you carry that through to its logical conclusion, and you've got a similar situation. So
this is the 30-day notice that the law required that's put into the Pentagon budget that they would give Congress a heads up of any release from Guantanamo. That was not done. We'll talk about why not. But the bigger issue here, or at least one people are talking about, Andrew, is whether this deal now puts a price on American soldiers' heads. We see Israeli soldiers swapped for sometimes hundreds of Palestinians. Now we've got a precedent, I guess you'd have to say. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the unfinished story of Bo Bergdahl, the swap for him and the American time in Afghanistan. Now headed toward a conclusion, the president says, supposed to be down below 10,000 troops by the end of this year, all troops out by the end of the Obama presidency. Andrew Tillman is with us. He's Pentagon Bureau Chief for the Military Times. He's written a lot about this case. David Rode is with us, investigative reporter with Reuters. He was with the New York Times when he was captured by the same group that held Bo Bergdahl. This was back in 2008. David Rode escaped after 7 months. He's with us today from New York. Lots of criticism as well as support on Capitol Hill. But here's Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. This was Sunday on ABC, questioning the terms of Bergdahl's release, said there may be long-term consequences.
How many soldiers lost their lives to capture those five Taliban terrorists that we just released? You know, Ambassador Rice basically said to you, yes, U.S. policy has changed. Now we make deals with terrorists. And the question going forward is have we just put a price on other U.S. soldiers? What does this tell terrorists?
We'll look at that question. We'll look at whether the Taliban are terrorists. Melinda, Montgomery, Alabama, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if what Susan Rice said, I think it's not so much that I'm upset that he was brought home, because, yes, he should have been brought home. But it's like she lied to us again, or the administration lied again, saying he served with honor and distinction. When they obviously knew that this stuff was going on, why would they say that upon saying that he was being returned?
Melinda, I appreciate your call. Andrew Tillman, there was an interesting, at the very least, a lack of acknowledgement of the complexity of this story when the news first came out. Rose Garden, almost celebration announcement with the parents and the rest. It almost seemed as though the White House thought that people wouldn't look at the whole story. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think you're right. In the hindsight of a couple of days, there was something a little bit askew about that initial presentation, as though there was not this sort of big asterisk or red flag by Bo Bergdahl's name. And you kind of saw over the course of the week the military begin to kind of try to respond to that. I mean, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, posted an interesting statement on his Facebook page yesterday, kind of clarifying that, the Army will not look the other way on misconduct, and it's important that we brought him home regardless of the circumstances. And it was interesting that hit that comment. I noticed got like, I think, 700 or 800 comments in the 24 hours to follow. So, I do think there was a certain delay, and I think that made it worse in some ways, because the people that were angry about this felt like their concerns were not really addressed up front.
Here's Bo Bergdahl. This was shortly after his capture in 2009. The Taliban then released a video in which he asks fellow Americans to do everything in their power to pressure the U.S. government to bring him home. Questioned the whole American mission in Afghanistan. Of course, he was a prisoner of the Taliban.
Please bring us home, so that we can be back where we belong and not over here wasting our time and our lives and our precious life that we could be using back in our own country.
Doesn't sound too good right there. Tom in Arcadia, Iowa. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd have to agree with Ted Cruz on this one. I have a child that's going to be going to serve in the Middle East next month, and I think my child is going to have a price on her head because, one guy who walked away is worth five top Taliban fighters. You know, gosh, could they just get 10 next time if they kidnap another military service member and keep that system going till Guantanamo won't have to be closed? It'll be empty.
Well, there are people who would like it empty, and that may be part of what's at play here as well. But Tom, let us pick that up. I mean, John McCain was making that point. Again, Republican, critic of the president here. This was on CBS Face the Nation, talking about the five Taliban commanders, we learned, who were released.
These are the hardest of the hardcore. These are the highest high-risk people. And others that we have released have gone back into the fight. That's been documented. So, and it's disturbing to me that the Taliban are the ones that named the people to be released.
David Rode, what do you make of this swap? Simplest question is that, I guess.
Well, as a country, we seem to have decided that we're going to leave Afghanistan. We're going to pull out all troops. And in a sense, I guess what puzzles me is the people that criticize this deal, are they and say that these Taliban are very dangerous. You know, are they also calling for U.S. troops to remain in Afghanistan? If we're going to end the war and we're going to leave Afghanistan, you have a prisoner trade. I think there's legal issues, and others know this better than me, but the legal authorization for holding these Afghans in Guantanamo, I think, lapses when U.S. combat operations end in Afghanistan, when we're no longer at war in Afghanistan. So there's this sort of broader question about what are the Taliban, which you've mentioned earlier, are they terrorists? And should we just – if they aren't terrorists and we're leaving Afghanistan, then what do you do with these prisoners?
Andrew Tillman, there's talk that – I mean even from Secretary Hagel, defense secretary, that this negotiation through Qatar may actually have helped open up conduits to the Taliban that may help ultimately with an American withdrawal.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting wrinkles to this is how surprised a lot of the military professionals were at how smooth this handoff went. You know, I mean, it was really – it went exactly as planned. The Taliban did exactly what they said they would do. And
I mean, they were nervous. People clearly feared an ambush. You can see from the body language of this handoff. But it went just as you say, just to plan, just to agreement.
Oh, sure. There was all sorts of precautions made. But ultimately, the Taliban did exactly what they said. And I think that I get the impression that was part of the calculus at the White House, that somehow if they could execute this in a way as they did, that might lead to some sort of follow-on relationship and better resolution to the war, which is winding down on its own.
On the other hand, we've heard a lot of people say the Taliban's not likely to give up here until they're back in charge in Afghanistan. And now they've got five more commanders. Maybe there's no shortage in any case, Andrew.
I don't know what the Taliban's long-term intent was. I mean, that's certainly their stated goal. But the White House seems to be has a pretty short timeline for the U.S. military mission there, and is not making any broad statements about what they're expecting in a few years out.
Other than don't expect paradise, the president says. Don't expect a model democracy. John in Grand Rapids, thanks for calling, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just a quick comment on Senator McCain. He was on CNN in February saying that he was open to such a trade. But my comment is really in regards to Senator Cruz referring to these five members of the Taliban as terrorists. Two points I'd like to hear the guests comment on.
Yes.
First, the difference between declaring war on a sitting government in Afghanistan and the war on terrorism, and why we're not calling these guys prisoners of war, rather Guantanamo detainees, because I think there's a reason for that, and the public needs to know what that is.
Of course, Afghanistan was hosting al-Qaeda at the beginning of all this long saga, but I take your point, David Rode. What about it? This kind of mushing together of terms here, perhaps. Have we just negotiated with terrorists and negotiating with the Taliban? Or, should it be seen under different terms? We're at war, old-fashioned war, in some sense, with the Taliban.
Well, it's interesting. The war in Iraq was an old-fashioned war. We did agree that Iraqis that we captured were prisoners of war, and there aren't any Iraqis in Guantanamo. Afghanistan, we created this sort of strange new precedent of everyone's a terrorist and we can detain them indefinitely. These five prisoners were held for 12 years. There's another 12 Afghans sitting in Guantanamo that the Taliban didn't even ask for. So it is a question. So these five had no links to 9/11. But you're right. The al-Qaeda did use Afghanistan as a base, and the Taliban helped them in that sense. So it's back to this larger question. If the Taliban come back, if these five rejoin the fight and there's no U.S. troops in Afghanistan, will the Taliban maybe target the U.S. in terrorist attacks? And we just don't seem to be looking at that question again as a country. We just are sort of getting out of Afghanistan and I guess assuming the Taliban are only a local threat and not a direct threat to us.
Do you see perhaps a deal here, David, for further releases from Guantanamo? I mean, the arrangement is these five Taliban commanders will be released. They were released as this handoff was taking place in eastern Afghanistan, which the whole country will see before nightfall. It's on all over the television now, showing him being led toward the Black Hawk helicopter there, the special forces, the Taliban fighters with him in that white kind of robe. Shortly after, in Guantanamo, these five were handed to Qatari officials who will take them to Qatar, where they're supposed to spend the next year before they can go wherever they like. Do you see a a model here, David, for somehow for more Guantanamo releases. The president said he would like to empty it, close it.
No, I don't see it as a model. I see this as the administration ending the war in Afghanistan. And I don't think there's any prospects for any kind of peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban. We've announced that we're leaving. There's no incentive for the Taliban to do it. You know, their focus is going to be on toppling the Afghan government. So I just see this as an administration that sees it's one of its legacies as pulling all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. And they probably didn't want to leave Bergdahl behind.
Peter in Boston. Thanks for calling, Peter. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, interesting show. Listen, I happen to be an attorney for many years, so I know a lot of the legal and the military law. But more importantly, I was a Marines in the 1st Marines. 1968, I was a corporal in the Rifle Company, 1st Marines, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines.
You're talking Vietnam then?
Yeah, Vietnam now. And I became the scout, so I used to get all the intel, so we'd pass it on. A lot of people don't know this, but there were people who crossed over. What did that mean? The Marines deserted. An Army personnel deserted and worked for the VC and NVA. We had reports, this is 68, of a white and black Marine who deserted and crossed over and were fighting for the NVA. Now, as it applies to, again, this whole thing with Bergdorf, I mean, clearly they need to use a huge investigation to go through things. I think the administration at least has to stop calling him a hero. But I can just go back to 68 when, again, these are kind of unknown facts that most people don't know about, that people actually crossed over fighting for the NVA VC. My job was to give information to the rifle platoons. We went out looking for these people. And I can tell you, the scout snipers, the recon Marines and us, we weren't going to take them prisoners. We were going to kill them. They had weapons. They were fighting with the NVA and VC. They were just as guilty, you know, as being an enemy combatant.
Peter, we've got it. I don't know that particular history, but I appreciate your call. Andrew Tillman, there's, as far as I know, zero suggestion here of Bergdahl as an active supporter of the Taliban he was with, or
I don't think that there's any real, you know, firsthand credible reports that he was anything other than a straightforward detainee, as David suggested his observations show as well.
David, how do you picture those years? 5 years is a long time that he spent in captivity in Pakistan. How do you picture what that may have been like?
Oh, I'm sure they're absolutely terrible. And to be honest, you know, you played earlier some audio from a tape he made when he was a hostage. It's not really fair. I made tapes like that. And,
sure.
You know, you've got guns pointed at your head.
Oh, yeah. We can hear his emotion, his fear.
Anything he said, he's under duress. There's been attacks on the father for this tweet he made, you know, mentioning that calling for prisoners to be released from Guantanamo. That's been taken out of context. He was also calling for the release of Americans being held prisoner in Syria and Iran and North Korea. And then the father's under duress as well. He's trying to send out tweets that the Taliban might see that will, you know, help keep
his
son
alive. Yeah.
So Bo Bergdahl, you know, walked off his base, according to the soldiers. I absolutely believe those soldiers. He made a terrible mistake. He should be held accountable for it. There should be an investigation. But he's had a horrific 5 years. My emotions as a captive during those 7 months, I mean, the first words I said to my wife and my mother and my family when I got out was, I love you and I'm sorry. So he's, you know, whatever led him off the base, maybe it was a mental breakdown. There's also reports of two Afghan soldiers disappearing. Did they trick him? Again, he's got to answer these questions. He doesn't get off the hook here. He has suffered terribly. He will regret this for the rest of his life. And I guarantee he's regretted walking off that base for the last 5 years.
Here was his mother, Jenny Bergdahl. This was on Sunday at a press conference in Haley, Idaho.
5 years is a seemingly endless long time. But you've made it. I imagine you are more patient and compassionate than ever. You are free. Freedom is yours. I will see you soon, my beloved son. I love you, Bo.
Andrew Tillman, what do you know, if anything, about exactly who will see whom when? When will he come back to the United States? Will he be united with his family? Will he be detained? Is it clear yet?
Yeah, the Army has a pretty clear reintegration process for people in this particular situation.
This is a very unusual situation.
Well, it is, but for people who have been captive, mm-hmm. He's in what they call phase two right now, where he's in kind of a bubble. He's not talking to his family. I don't think he's seeing any kind of media reports. I don't think he has access to the internet. He's talking to some psychologists and some other people, and mm-hmm. at some point, no timeline yet, but he will be brought to a Army hospital in San Antonio, where he will be then given, he'll be given an attorney, he'll be given a financial advisor, he'll be given a chaplain, and there will be like a larger group that will surround him and begin the final process of introducing him back into society. And there's no, as I said, there's no timeline for that. So I don't think my question for those guys right now is, have they essentially read him his rights? You know, because anything he could say, they have to read him his rights before they could use anything he says as part of the investigation. I suspect they have not read him his rights, and they're probably just not thinking about that right now, that they're figuring that they're going to reintegrate him during the routine process and deal with the investigation that's unique to him down the road.
The early comment out of the military was that, you know, he's prisoner for 5 years. Maybe that's enough, whatever his reasons for leaving. Now that's grown a little more stern, as you say. If there are going to be charges, when might we learn that?
I don't know. That's a really interesting question. The Secretary of the Army said yesterday that he would do this at some point in the future after Bergdahl is completed his reintegration process. You know, there's a whole lot of legal options that the Army could take in terms of court-martial, non-judicial punishment. They could medically retire him. There's all sorts of things. So there's a lot of questions that the Army Command has to deal with.
I want to fully acknowledge how many of those questions are outstanding. Lots of speculation about what happened. There has been reporting, as Andrew Tillman has done, and others, on Army internal reports. But I guess we'll let this all take its course to learn in full what there is to be known about this long, sad story. But at least he's free now. He's out. The soldier's come on his way, anyway, home. Andrew Tillman, I want to thank you for joining us today. Pentagon Bureau Chief of the Military Times, thanks for joining us from Washington.
Thank you.
And David Rode, particularly good to have you with us today, investigative reporter now for Reuters, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thanks so much.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.